Hello, and welcome to the Real Life Podcast. I'm your host, Jennifer McKee. I'm so excited to have you join me each week as we explore a variety of topics around life in the greater Palm Springs area. From real estate market updates to lifestyle topics, interesting people, food and entertainment, we keep it authentic and fun. Please be sure to like, subscribe, and follow Jennifer McKee Realtor on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube to keep up to date on everything happening in the Coachella Valley. Also, be sure to go to Apple Podcasts and like and leave a review for this show. I really appreciate it. And now, without further ado, let's go to this week's show. Hey, thanks for joining us today. We have a great show planned for you. Ryan interviewed Paul Shavelson. And Paul is such an interesting guy. It's a phenomenal interview. He is a producer. He created the FX channel and creator, producer of the hit show Crossing Over with John Edwards. I don't know if you remember that. And an author. I mean, just leads a fascinating life. So you're going to really enjoy that. But before we get to that, I wanted to talk briefly about real estate, home values in this pandemic time that we're in, because I'm getting inundated with lots of questions, phone calls, texts, emails of people, even people that aren't in the market to buy or sell. Homeowners are wondering what this pandemic is doing to their home value. And I can't speak to the whole country because it's different in different places, but where we're at here in the greater Palm Springs area, home values are staying steady and strong, and that has a lot to do with supply and demand. So there is still a huge group of buyers out there looking, but sellers, there's not as many sellers. So supply is low, demand is high, and what does that do to value? It keeps it strong. In fact, I had an offer that was, there was multiple offer scenario, and my buyer had to go above asking on a very expensive home in order to win that deal. So that has happened several times in the last couple weeks, and that lets me know that it's a seller's market still and values are strong.
Well, and too, isn't the big issue that's different now than it was in 2008 is 2008 you had an oversupply of inventory, which then drove prices to the bottom when everything started to crash. Whereas now there's less inventory, there's a demand for housing, especially out here, and I think it's similar across
most
the country.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to probably have prices that will stay relatively stable.
For sure. I really, all of the outside factors of the 2008 situation are very different than what we're dealing with now. And during this whole pandemic and the stay-at-home orders, we've had a lot of supply was already a little low, demand was high, and then sellers, a lot of people have put their homes on hold or withdrawn from the market. A lot of sellers are waiting until the stay-at-home orders are lifted in their areas. Now, I still have sellers listing their homes. I had two listings this week, but they are holding off a little bit, and buyers are still hungry to buy. So that I've been telling people that there's a lot of data that backs up. I don't want to get into all the numbers and bore you with all that, but there's a lot of data and numbers that back that up. So I just wanted to let you know that if you're a homeowner and you're not even looking to sell, I really believe that your value of your home is going to stay strong. You're not going to be upside down. And if you're a seller, people are wanting to buy, so list that house.
And if people are wanting to get an idea of where their house is at, you know, comparative analysis and kind of how the market looks and all that, I mean, you know, they can contact you and you can do all that, right?
For sure. It's I love doing that kind of thing. So let me know, free, I'll do it for free, no pressure. Even if you're just wanting to know the value of your home, even if you're not wanting to sell, I'm more than happy to give you a comparative market analysis and email that to you. So reach out to me at go to my website, jennifermckee.com. Okay, so now before we get into this interview, I wanted to also say that Paul Shavelson, he bought a home up in the Joshua Tree area in Yucca Valley, and that we call that the high desert. We're in the low desert here in the greater Palm Springs area. And it's maybe, you know, 20-minute drive from Palm Springs, give or take.
And north of Palm Springs.
Yes, north of Palm Springs, and it's a very different vibe, very different community. If any of you've ever gone up there to Joshua Tree National Park, you know what I'm talking about. People ask me, why would someone want to buy a home up there? What is the appeal? And really the appeal is, well, there's several things. One is home values and home prices. What you can get for your money up there is greater. So housing prices are really low. So that's a win right there. A lot of people will go up there because they want, you know, part of Joshua Tree, that whole area's identity is its location in the desert. And it offers locals and even tourists the chance to get away from the city and live and de-stress out in nature. And so people love that, especially since it's just far enough away from the city, but close. In fact, actually, according to the LA Times, it was once a sleepy area, but now it's one of the most popular getaway destinations near Los Angeles.
And it has a real, coming from the Pacific Northwest, when we were up in the Bellingham, Seattle, Portland area, where you had a lot of hippies, hipsters, artists, and creators and writers, and you know that whole culture. It's craft breweries and coffee shops and all that kind of stuff.
Organic, like that, vegan.
That whole culture has kind of come to the desert out there in the Mojave Desert and sort of built this lifestyle commune kind of space. And so all of those people that are in LA that really are kind of connected and drawn to that type of environment flock out there all year long, for photography, for, you know, to go to restaurants, to go to bars, to, you know, get to their house and go painting. And it's a really cool vibe.
It's a very artsy community. A lot of people will go out there because they just want to be connected with nature, and they'll work remotely. A lot of freelance artists out there. It's really got an intimate and creative community of artists, designers, and creators. And you can actually discover that on Instagram. But because they have quite an Instagram community of how they get together and meet. But it's a really cool place. And if you were just driving through, you wouldn't maybe notice that. If you're just driving through without really paying attention, you feel like you're out in the middle of nowhere and there's not a lot of people around. But that's not true. It's a very creative, artsy place. You get a chance to be out in nature, see the stars, wildlife, all of that stuff, and at a lower cost of living. And also, the weather is different. Even though it's 20 minutes from the low desert here, the winters are a little chillier. When I go up there to show houses, which is not often, but actually did to Paul Shavelson, and he bought a home up there. That's how I met Paul.
They had a nice snowstorm up there this last winter.
I know, it's so crazy. And then in the summer, it's cooler.
Which is really cool in the desert when you get snow everywhere.
I know, right? The summer, it's a great place to, I mean, it still gets hot, but not nearly as intense as down here when it's like 120. So that, it's really a desirable place to live, and more people are buying up land, building homes, building artist retreats. There's a lot of vacation homes, Airbnbs up there. So anyway, I'm excited for this interview with Paul. I think you're going to enjoy it.
Paul, thank you for taking the time to join the podcast and let me chat with you a little bit here about your life. You guys are in the high desert up there in Yucca Valley, Joshua Tree area. How are things for you right now with the quarantine? And is life up there still ticking along okay? Or,
well, it's a combination of unknowns. You know, we're very recent to the Morongo Basin and haven't really explored it in its full capacity. We've only seen it in this handicapped shutdown. So it's a challenge every day to really figure out what it is and what we're doing and where we are, not just because of the pandemic, because we're newbies. And, you know, we've been here less than 4 months, and the plan was to be able to come in and out of Palm Springs. No, that's not happening. And the plan was to be hiking Joshua Tree. Well, that just reopened. And so we've been without all of the preconceived asset. So it's been a very enlightening, but, you know, self-discovery kind of period, which for everyone, I'm sure, it's not about us. It's just, it's very easy for me to focus on it because I'm doing this in an unknown era and in an unknown territory. And, you know, that's okay. That's part of the growth.
You mentioned Joshua Tree is just, the park has just reopened. I saw that yesterday. And I hadn't even thought about it because I'm, you know, we live here full time year round, but for those that are seasonal, we're in sort of that, you know, January to April, May area timeframe is like gorgeous weather. It's the best time of year here. And then everybody's been trapped inside, which is like the whole reason you come down here to the desert is to be able to enjoy the sunshine and get away from, you know, being cooped up inside in the north. So yeah, that would be one of those just additional like frustrations of, I mean, I'm right here. I just want to get out and enjoy nature and, you know, hike the trails and you can't. And everybody up in that area, you know, most of the homes, people choose to live up there because there's a lot of space. You know, they can get out there, they can get some land, they've got a lot of solitude, and there's shops and restaurants and places to go. I'm assuming obviously all that's shut down, but you don't have that same sense of, there's community up there, but it's not like you would here where you have, you know, 4,000 people living in one gated area. Have people, is there a sense of community up there as you go to the stores? Do people feel like they're all kind of still working together, or is it just you don't know anybody yet, so you really haven't had a chance to build that?
I have. It's funny because on both sides of that story, I heard a neighbor doing some work on her property, and it's right next door, and so I thought I would go and introduce myself. And I scared the heck out of her because I could pop out of, you know, around her driveway. And I said, you know, I live next door and I just wanted to say hi because we've only recently got here. And she said, oh, my God, we've been here 2 years and you're the first neighbor that we met.
Wow.
And then she didn't even know the house was for sale. That she didn't know the old owners. She thought maybe she noticed there wasn't as many dogs running around, but she wasn't sure. But that's the type of community we are in the basin here, that it is spread out. On the other side of that coin is that we met two wonderful couples, one hiking and one at Vons. Hmm. And we were just immediately bonded to these, and they don't know each other. One's up in Landers, the other's in Morongo Valley. And we do this socially distant hike together or outdoor picnic in one of our yards so we can maintain social distancing. But as you get older, it's more difficult to meet people in general, I found. So, but in a pandemic, I wouldn't be surprised if these four people aren't friends of ours for the rest of our lives. And what's that about? I mean, what's the syncretic in a way that, you know, they were at the trail at the same time we were, or they were at Line and Vons at the same time. And so it's just always amazing to me who you catch up with, you know, and why and when. And so it's always been a very unusual thing. But the fact that there is no community is very, very obvious to us here.
It reminds me a bit when Jen and I moved down here 4 years ago, around this time of year. We were from Washington. We had all of our friends and family and connections up there. We bought an RV, packed the kids up, and headed south to LA. And went to campgrounds, different communities, you know, and it's a very transient kind of community, the RV people. And, you know, you got a lot of retirees. But then we had families that were just doing it for, you know, 4, 5, 6 months, homeschool families and stuff. But it was wild. I was shocked at the number of relationships that we would connect with somebody for a short term. And because now of social media and Facebook and all that, you can stay connected. But we were some of our closest, dearest friends now came out of that time. And, you know, you still continue to see each other and hook up now, and they're in LA, and we're, and it's amazing to me how just the, you can live next to somebody in a house for 20 years and really never get to know them. You hop in an RV and you randomly hit somebody in a a park somewhere in North Hollywood, and it's like friends for life. It's just, there's something about that bond, I think, sometimes with people, like you guys are experiencing up there in a pandemic.
Yeah, and it's really amazing. In New York City, where I lived for 3 decades, I don't think I might have waved at neighbors, but we didn't really sit down and have meals. We might have caught up with each other on a corner coffee mm-hmm. shop, but we didn't make plans together. Here, it's different. It's a different, you know, the density of population is not, you know, being forgotten by this virus or the social networking that you create. You know, each mm-hmm. and every one of these relationships fills up a volume that 50 relationships could have.
Yeah.
So it's a whole different mix, right?
Yeah, no, it's totally true. So you mentioned the East Coast. Obviously, Yucca Valley and Morongo Valley and all this area out here is not home. This is a new place for you guys. So the East Coast is home. Is that where you were kind of born, raised, or just...
Right. So yeah, I'm totally a New Yorker. I was born in Jersey City, lived in Manhattan for close to 27 years, and then raised a family out on Long Island. Huh. And my kids are out there now, even though they live in Brooklyn. Each, I have two kids. One's a producer for CBS Sunday Morning, and the other is a jazz pianist at the New School of Jazz.
Oh, wow.
And they both live in Brooklyn, but they both got out of there during the pandemic and are now re-entering their lives. My daughter, within 2 weeks, will be back in Park Slope, Brooklyn. But my son, who lives in Bushwick, Brooklyn, where it's totally the ground zero of this pandemic, he is not sure when he'll go back, because the school itself is in Manhattan, but they probably are going to continue online mm-hmm. with very little live interaction, which totally is not what he signed up for. I mean, no one signed up for what they're going through right now, but as a young person, it's just, I can't even imagine what you think, because you don't have, you hadn't lived through, you know, really 9/11, or you haven't lived through many storms, hurricanes, wars. This is a challenge. And so for a musician, which is a pretty much a solitude type of discipline 90% of the time, when you can't perform and let that go, mm-hmm. you know, that's what all that pent-up energy is for. You practice, you compose, you do all of that thing, and then you go in front of how many people you can get into a jazz venue. But that's, you know, that's gone.
Yeah.
So anyway, I am an East Coaster, and I've always wanted to spend more time other than Los Angeles. I've always been intrigued with the desert, and picked this place specifically for solitude. But this is more than I bargained for, in a sense.
Yeah, the pandemic has sort of forced solitude on all of us. I mean, I'm generally an introvert. I get my energy from being alone. Actually, it's the last 8-9 weeks have been pretty stressful around our house, because we've got 5 kids, and it's been very hectic with everybody home. Yesterday, Jen decided they wanted to try to take the kids late to go see the bioluminescence in the ocean. So she took the kids and drove. I cleaned the house like mad. Turned on some music, lit some candles. I mean, that was like recharge city for me, because I've been just so oversensitized for several months now. And then, of course, they got there and didn't get to see anything. There was none of the bioluminescence was flared up or whatever. So they were like, this was a 2-hour drive for nothing. But they got them out of the house. But anyway, yeah, so I can appreciate the isolation piece. But So when your story is really interesting, and one of the reasons I was excited to chat with you was you've had a very kind of eclectic career, and it seems like you've been able to follow interests and passions. And I know you've gotten involved in a bunch of different kinds of projects and written books and things. I'd love to hear a little bit about, you know, you're in New York. Is that where you began working in production? Tell me a little bit about kind of your journey there.
So I was in the 70s, 1975, finishing up a program called the University Without Walls, which was a free adjunct at the New School where my son is. And I took my requirements at an art school in Rhode Island at Roger Williams, which is now a university. So I was living in New York in the Lower East Side on a 5-story tenement while I was finishing up my schoolwork, but getting very little production PA work because my film study and my television study was my interest. And something happened where I landed in a niche of shooting art galleries and openings and art performances that opened up a other side of production. You know, I literally had a reel-to-reel Sony Portapak on my back in what was burgeoning Soho. It wasn't even Soho, New York. And I landed, I would say, 1976, doing video installations in art galleries, and some of them were major galleries. Mm. And I just happened to be there. The New York State Council of the Arts had a program where I would check out video equipment for artists, and most of these artists wanted nothing to do with it, so they would pay me like $20 or $40 to come with my camera and shoot an opening, and met people there, I guess. And the rest was more of a well, where can I live? And then I was offered office space down in what became Tribeca if I wanted to live there. And I did that. And while I was doing that, I was introduced to some renegade video guerrillas who wanted to start shooting fashion. And they were publishers and they knew nothing about really video. So I started shooting fashion and helped launch a company called Video Fashion, which still is in existence today, and started shooting and mostly field producing, production managing, editing, shooting runway fashion in like 1977, 1978, that over the next 5 years took me all over the world. So it was not like, you know, a plan or a map. And it was a very exciting time in New York. You know, it was what you read about, and it's been portrayed. You know, I was literally at one of the openings at Studio 54 shooting it, and you know, I lived a block away from the Mud Club, so I was energized, not making a lot of money, but I didn't really know what that was about anyway. But that really seeded my career into what I now consider myself an executive production assistant, because I'm always a production assistant. And right. Now it's not as much lifting, but I think half of my success in those days was is that I was just willing and able and strong to drag many, many pounds of television equipment around.
Yeah.
At a very fast pace, and I was glad to do it because it gave me the opportunity to, you know, see music videos being shot or be part of the crew, and I just love the vibe and the energy, and the collaboration just hit me right at that period of time. And then there was burnout, and And
as we all go through.
Right. It's like, wow, yeah. I can't do this much longer. So I transitioned my video in a way that I went into a company that was owned by Newsweek. And we did features like for that was independently distributed by Newsweek magazine and created a video magazine called Newsweek Woman that was on cable. And cable was just happening. And every magazine that existed in print wanted a version for cable TV, you know, every magazine. So I was just happened to be there and I had some experience and spent a good decade in cable TV. And, you know, that was good. And then at night I donated equipment and still stayed alive in the arts community and shoot arts. I worked at the local public television station for 5 years at night and did a lot of industrials because at that point, corporate America wanted to find ways to spend money on internal communications. And it was a time where money was happening, but it was really weird because a lot of that video messaging was really to find higher profit margins, which when the computer came in, people were losing their jobs left and right. So, you know, the phone companies, the community, the travel companies were all going through their transition. Instead of, you know, growing, they were actually, it looked like they were growing because they were spending money in internal communications, but they were really, in a sense, right-sizing or downsizing. And it became annoying to me that I was part of the machine of corporate greed, but it was a gig and we did that. And then,
but it's interesting how you've been able to, and I think a lot of producers that I meet, yeah, especially younger producers or people that are aspiring producers, you seem to be able to follow opportunity. And, you know, yes, you were lucky in that you were kind of positioned, you know, to be in the mid, late 70s, early 80s in New York in the fashion and video world as that's all happening. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of timing things that were really cool, but you took advantage of that. And it doesn't sound like you had a very romantic view of filmmaking and production and all that, like a lot of young aspiring filmmakers that I know seem to have. And there's nothing wrong with that, but they will oftentimes limit themselves on opportunity because they're living in sort of a fantasy of this is what filmmaking or Hollywood or whatever is supposed to look like. It's the 60s and 70s. It's the Spielberg era. It's the, you know, John Wayne era, whatever. And I only want to shoot on these kinds of projects and I only want to do this. And really, production is the people who seem to last the longest and make the most money and pay their bills are those who go, it's a job. And this is what the marketplace is looking for. Let me bring art and talent and creativity to that and do the best that I can. But at the end of the day, the audience determines what they want. It's, you know, I can have some vision of this thing, but nobody will show up. I don't get to do this twice. You know, I'll raise millions of dollars and make my movie. No one sees it. That's it. So if you want to make more than one movie, you need to understand what an audience is looking for. You've been able to kind of just follow these trends and take advantage of it. Is that what led you to FX and
let me tell you, how about the missed opportunities, okay? Like 1977, when I was doing the State Council checking out equipment for the Media Equipment Resource Center on Rivington Street, which is now a big trendy bar, and three friends got a grant from the State Council and the National Endowment to get an Apple II computer in 1978. And what we proposed was to put not-for-profit organizations on a computerized mailing list. And the media was an audio cassette with a cassette player hooked up to your Apple II. And I struggled with that technology. There wasn't, you know, shortcuts. It was all machine language. And even though I had edited video, I didn't transition quickly and got totally frustrated. And the feds were totally against us putting a computerized mailing list of subversive art organizations. And so that was pushing it down. But instead of like going and really figuring out, but this is the future, the computer, I went back into production. And so that, you know, yeah, I saw opportunities, but I've missed many.
That's fair, sure.
And so when I was at the public television station, we created a couple of phone-in talk shows and very low budget and based on radio format, and but with cameras, and people could watch it on WNYC, and I wanted to expand that. So I created a concept called Think Tank, which is like Nightline Live, phone in, and right there and then, you know, CNN was just happening, MTV was just happening. And I went to friends of mine that were a Fox, and they offered me a position on a tabloid show called Current Affair. And I had no feel for it at all. I didn't want to get involved with that. Well, that was such a blunder, because not only did my friends work and executively produce Current Affair, they created Inside Edition. Mm. It became a genre.
Right.
And I always was thought of as like the idiot that just passed on that. I don't know what my position would have been, but it was startup. Mm. And I love startup. Anyway, when I chose this much different route on public television, and when I created this concept called Think Tank, I went to them and at Fox, and I got a phone call within a week and said, you know what, we really like this. We're going to be creating our first cable network, and we want you to be part of it. And that was FX, and that was like 1993 or 92 was the startup. And those general concepts of live interactive is exactly what they wanted to do on FX, but it wasn't a late night talk show. It became a morning show called Breakfast Time on FX, and that's how we launched their network. And I was the original producer for that show and became an executive producer. And it was an amazing ride, because now I was producing television that I wanted to do live interactive with Rupert Murdoch's financing. Hmm. And that was a year before Roger Ailes created Fox News. Then I had an office at News Corp right next to him. And he slowly just took apart our project and morphed it into Fox and Friends and other Fox projects that had a political agenda. And I was so naive, and even though I wasn't a kid anymore, that there was more at stake than making fun, good live TV. Our TV was hot. We had, you know, Tom Bergeron was our host. We had Phil Cogan. We had Jeff Probst. All these guys just starting out, interacting. And, you know, Phil jumping out of a plane with a microwave link, taking you on a first-person skydive. And we did that as Aretha Franklin was sitting in our studio next to Tom. She won't fly. And I thought she was going to wet herself, because it was so live. And that's what I was interested in. It was the challenge. I wasn't really watching the ball. And eventually the show was put to sleep and a political agenda took over. And and then we've seen what happened. It really became a divisive process for media to actually not just make television, but to make television as propaganda on both sides. I mean, I can't really, you know, I have friends on CNN too, but I can't watch it because I know they're preaching to their choir. Fox is preaching to their choir, but and I do try to catch the PBS NewsHour every so often just so I could see left to center, but hopefully not as, you know, hateful as our media divide. And it's sad for me because I didn't see that coming.
Your time at FX and all of that, was that then what led you to crossing over, or how did that show and relationship come about?
So I, you know, in this business, right, in between is a very scary place, you know, and I was pitching and piloting and working on projects for other people. And I did everything. I was a senior communication expert for the state of New York on the I Love New York campaign. I had worked on different projects, but one project was people at NBC were looking at getting involved at USA Cable, more cable projects. The only thing that was highly successful was their wrestling project, World Wrestling Federation. So they asked me if I would be interested in mounting a show, which was a parody of The View, and it was called The Other View. And The Other View was, instead of women discussing things, it was wrestlers discussing everything except wrestling. And I was literally working on a concept, trying to figure out, I don't get it, so it must be good. Because at that point, you know, I'm the guy that passed up current affairs. So anyway, friends of mine were involved in a project. They had identified this psychic, and they would ask me if I would look at this VHS tape of psychic John Edward working at Holiday Inn, and it was on my desk. So I had to find a VHS machine. I went into the basement of a building in Chelsea at All Mobile Video, and I have a bunch of cassettes, and I'm working on The Other View. And the office that I'm borrowing, the phone rings and the phone rings and the phone rings. And it's one of those moments like, I don't even know whose office is. Do I pick up the phone? So anyway, this is how it went down, is that I picked up the phone. I said, hello. And on the other side of the phone, he said, hi, this is John Edward. And I said, really? I got your cassette here. I'm just about to pop it in. He says, well, you know, my name is Paul Shavelson. And he said immediately, oh, I know who you are. You're the guy that wouldn't let me on any of the FX shows. I said, oh, really? I had astrologers on, but I wasn't really big into psychics. And I said, he says, what do you think? And I watched, you know, I've seen tapes of psychic games. I didn't know what it was all about. And I said, well, it looks like it's okay. I understand what a television concept would be to this. It's not a problem. My friends who have shot this, who have thought that you were good, I respect. But I won't know anything until I see this go down in front of me. He says, well, within a week, he says that there's a psychic retreat in Barbados where I'll be working. I said, oh, yeah, well, I'll go to Barbados and check that out for sure. I said, okay. And the next day there were tickets to Barbados that Sci-Fi was that interested in seeing if there was a show there, that they flew a couple of us down, my director, Dana Calderwood, and we checked it out, and John and I struck a friendship and landed up working together for 10 years where,
wow,
you know, at the last side of it, about 5 or 6 years ago, we bought a TriCaster, which is the kind of like the baby step to Zoom. And he's been transmitting on the internet, interactive programming on for over 5 years, because I saw that as totally being a great way to get that out. But we did Crossing Over. We did a few hundred episodes of that, and then we transitioned it to John Edward Cross Country. And it was really about the stories of the people that were getting these readings, and we felt good about it. It wasn't, even though, you know, we got criticized for, like, in Time Magazine swore that we hid microphones online to the audience and we knew what they were there for. He didn't. John was just very, very sensitive, very, very capable of picking up a vibe and then telling people what, you know, what's missing from their connection to someone they passed. And I didn't need to analyze it. I just saw the comfort he was getting. And then when we would go and do some packages with these people after the reading, not before, we never did before because we didn't know what their story was, I saw the relief and what this meant to them. So I felt very, very good about that project.
I mean, you spent 10 years with him. I remember when the show came out and the whole thing blew up. I mean, it was, I remember just that riot of that experience with him, was everywhere at the time. Do you feel, I mean, was there any kind of, I know as a television producer, you're making a show. And for you, it is the story. I mean, people don't think about that oftentimes, even the news. I mean, it's the story. Friends of mine, this is a side note, you know, will get upset sometimes when they'll see the media post a picture of something else that somebody has used. You know, it's Iowa riots and it's a photo of somebody in Florida, and they're not realizing, you know, the speed at which people are trying to develop and tell these stories. They're grabbing things. It's not always about, like, quote unquote accuracy. It's about, this represents a riot. This explains what we're trying to tell visually. Let's just put this up. And people think that there's all this manipulation with it and stuff. But I mean, you know, as a storyteller and as a television producer and somebody who's trying to communicate something that already has probably a bit of a stigma to it, what was your journey in terms of with John and that experience? I mean, did it open your eyes to things? Did it help you become more intuitive in yourself and maybe how you relate to people?
Right.
What was your experience with that as far as,
It was a growth experience for me. It was, you know, I've been on a spiritual quest like we all have. Before I started meditating in like 1976, and just for my own internal growth process and, you know, relaxation, I also started working out. You know, I'm doing things that I think are going to help me grow. And I found that was really a growth spurt for me to be much more sensitive to every single person, because what they have gone through, you have no idea. And how they are, you know, transitioning their lives to get on with it. And I'll tell you how it ended, the Crossing Over. It's that we were supposed to be writing a book together on the Mayan prophecy in 2012. And exactly at the moment that we started the book, my late wife was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. And the idea of the book was to interview all psychics, astrologers, philosophers, anthropologists. What were the Mayans trying to tell us? And I took the opportunity to finish the book on my own. John wrote the foreword. But as I was doing it, I was actually writing it in the hallways of Memorial Sloan Kettering, as my late wife was dying. And I was journaling that process. And I went to the editors at Macmillan at the very end of writing this book before she passed. I said, you know, I think the journals are much more interesting than the interviews about, you know, 2012 is a new beginning. Everyone just says it was the, you know, the dawning of Aquarius, and the Mayans didn't end the calendar. They just didn't know what to do next anyway. But my story was, is, you know, a personal story about transitioning. And the people at Macmillan said, you know what, we get it. And we wove the journals into this book called, you know, Beyond the Mayan Prophecy. And the book was quite successful. So I know that personally, I wouldn't have taken that shot if I hadn't been through the crossing over experience, because I understand transition, life, and love on a very personal level. And so I know it, you know, crossing over gave me the avenue, not just the platform, but the confidence. And I think people, they read it, tell me that, you know, yeah, they went through that. They know what it's like to lose a loved one, but the memory of them carries on, and your life continues in a different chapter. And my life has certainly done that. It's got me to the desert.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I can see how, especially with crossing over, it definitely impacts your ability to have empathy because of all those stories. I mean, you know, you're just around it all the time, but then you go through your own tragedy. How did your sort of crossing over preparation set you up then to process your own grief? And with the loss of your wife, I mean, were there things that maybe you saw John doing or that you had experienced that allowed you to sort of to not run from it, but embrace that to some degree?
Right. So, you know, one of the things that I decided to do was continue to create instead of just like getting totally consumed by the grief and quitting. So I understood from, I don't know, hundreds and hundreds of people who are connecting to life in general, much larger than our tangible life. My dog is snoring right next to me. I don't know
funny.
If you
hear. No, I don't hear it.
I hope it's the only being snoring at this point. But I can tell you an offshoot is that the agent on that book called me like three years after and said, you know what, we were talking here on a series of books and we wanted to see if you ever really vetted out this diet that you wrote. And I said, what? And I'm still grieving at this point, so that's why I'm telling the story. And I said, I have no idea what you're talking about. Well, apparently while I was editing Crossing Over, they used to bring in lunch to the edit room. This is in the days where you had edit rooms and edit facilities and PAs, and total overproduction. And I got bored with the lunches and I had started just a joke that, you know, it just get me the flattest thing on the menu. And what does that mean? Well, you know, why is that? Well, I believe I must have said this, that if you eat flat food, you will flatten your stomach because everybody wants a flat stomach. And it might have gone on for weeks. I don't know where I would decide, well, do I want a pizza or a sandwich? Well, pizza's flatter. Or do you, you know, what, you want a cup of soup or a bowl of soup? Well, a bowl. And this Asian thought it was the funniest thing that she had ever heard. And I don't even remember these conversations because you're in the edit, you're just, you know, trying to get through the day. So I wrote a concept on a book called Flat Food, Flat Stomach, where you actually flatten things and then it's about portion control and then your stomach will flatten. And I just sent her the the concept. And then I realized that that's about a 30-page book. I weaved it into personal travels of different cultures that I see that eat flat food. And then I started creating some flat diets. And by the time 8-9 months later, I lost 20 pounds. And I had created these yoga poses while you cook and flatten your food. And that was the end of it. No, they called back and said, yes, they want to green light the book. And I wrote this book called Flat Food, Flat Stomach, which is just a mind over matter concept of what is enough. And when it comes to food and to exercise and humor. So it's all tongue in cheek that, you know, that if you sit there, I mean, there's video of me at a book signing, taking a big cupcake and flattening it and then cutting it like a pizza and giving people little tastes. I said, well, if I would have given you each a cupcake, you know, how much difference that is in volume. And, so I went and finished this very satirical diet because everyone's diet crazy, but it's really about putting it into your brain. I wasn't expecting that I was going to lose this 20 pounds and feel better. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it matters what the concept is if you really just follow through. And I know that is an offshoot of belief systems that I really accepted while I was working with a bunch of psychics, John being the most notable. But, you know, we went all over the world. We went to Africa, we went to Europe, and people got it because of the belief system, and it's a connection, and it's a brain wiring. So flat food, flat stomach is a brain wiring. And it wasn't as well received as Beyond the Mayan Prophecy. And I understand why, because it almost looks like I'm making fun of the process, but it's not really what I'm doing.
Are you still writing then? Is that what you're doing up there in the mountains, in the desert?
Oh, I'm out here. And there was a couple of things I was going to do before I leave this planet and write a novel. Like everybody else that was in my business. So I've just finished a novel that I will try to shop next year. I'm not sure how that's going to go. I'm not sure of anything, but I'm sure that I have the time to do it. And if I just have the will, you know, it's done. So that's what I'm doing out here is working on it. And in creating television concepts.
Still, so you're still working on stuff.
Yeah, I have one out here that I wanted to do about some alien chasing, and I couldn't think of a better spot than Joshua Tree to do it. So, it's a very cool show, and I thought I'd be out here this year going to LA pitching it. Well, that didn't happen because of the pandemic and all of that.
Yeah, and you guys are getting ready to leave the desert, right, and head back east.
We're going to head back east for the summer, at least. My family's there. We're putting our beautiful house up on Airbnb, which was always the concept. I don't know. You know, we had to wait until the governor opened up San Bernardino County for vacation rentals. So the timing is now, and it's just being offered now for the summer. Maybe on longer, we'll see. Because there's just no plan that actually comes through the same way that you plan it.
Yeah. This may be an ignorant question. I'm just curious because I've never actually been out to Long Island. I would think in summer, you know, especially in the East Coast, Midwest is where I grew up, but it's humid. But do you get enough breeze coming in off the water that it keeps
you down? Yeah, I've been very, very fortunate to live close enough to the water.
Okay.
But it's not like Chicago or other places. Right. It's sweltering with humidity. There, you know, it gets hot. The bays and the ocean get warm, and then it storms, and then it cools down. It's one of the most interesting things about me being in the desert is not knowing anything about the ecosystem, but I know that one. I know because I've always lived somewhere near a river or a bay, or close enough to the ocean. Like you said yesterday, Jen took a 2-hour ride to the ocean. I'm a 10-minute ride to the ocean.
Right, right, sure. Yeah, and it was wild for her because, you know, it's 90 degrees here. I think it's actually maybe even the 80s, but, you know, it'll be 100, 110, and you drive to the ocean and it's 75. You know, it's amazing that just short couple of hours and the temperature changes are dramatic. So you've also got Beth, who is an artist, and is she back in the East Coast right now?
No, she's with me. She's been here
for here? Okay.
60 days. And okay. And we're going back, you know, we'll be back June 1st, basically. And she's painted an amazing series about social distancing. And I love the paintings that she's doing out here. She's the most incredible person.
She's on Instagram, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Do
you know her Instagram handle by chance?
I have to look it up because it just comes up for me. I think it's Beth OD.
Okay. So people can find her there.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, you know, she's just working on a series of paintings that are just so intense. You should really talk to her. She's got a great story, a great story.
Yeah, no, I love artists and musicians. And it's, I mean, your family sounds like you guys are right in that space that for me, I mean, that's just the world that I connect with, you know.
Yeah.
I love business people. I love, you know, all the science and technology and all those things too. But there's something in my sort of cellular level that when I get around other artists and storytellers and painters, it's just like my tribe, you know. It's like, man, I connect.
Right.
So
yeah, me too. I don't purposely try to omit other people in my life. Just the magnetism to that energy, whatever that is, that, oh, you make art, don't you?
Yeah.
We've met a few people, the two couples. One is a singer, songwriter, and the other is a dancer. You know, it's just like of all the people, it just happens like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I have a weird sort of affinity too for, there's a great book that somebody wrote. It's about multi-potentialites, but there's sort of like the Mozarts of the world. And then there's like the Ben Franklins of the world. And the Mozarts are those who kind of pick one path and they know their thing and they excel at it and they've done it their whole life and they're great. And that's fine. And then there's sort of the Ben Franklins, which they do a little this, they do a little that, they have a little this, and both successful, but they just have different paths. And most of the world tries to force people to become a Mozart when there's a lot of us that are over here in this Ben Franklin space that are like, you know, I'm going to start a business and I'm going to, you know, be a painter and I'm going to be an inventor and I'm, you know, whatever. And there's not as much, especially in modern society, sort of celebration of those people. We just, because we don't know how to compartmentalize them and label them and all that. And I'm always just sort of naturally drawn to those kinds of people because I'm like, it just, that feels like my tribe. You know, it's like, man, there's something about that. Not that I have anything against those Mozarts out there. I envy that and wish that I had that at sometimes. But I just think, man, somebody who's a writer and a producer and a, you know, musician, whatever. And it's like, yeah. So it's fun when I get to talk to people that are in that sort of space.
Well, good. I'm glad that you've validated what I am. I always thought, well, one of these days I'm going to figure out what I want.
Well, I'm constantly trying to figure out for myself. So.
Well, I'm glad that you're doing this podcast because that's a good thing to do. That's what's happening. It's, you know, with sharing communications as a specialty, we can't all be interested in the same things.
Yeah.
And looking at your books, it's quite impressive behind.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. This is my happy place. No, I mean, for me it too, it's, and one of the things that Jen and I talked about with the podcast, I mean, you know, I'm a story guy and there's so many stories of people here in this area. And how it relates to the stories of the community and the businesses and restaurants and arts and all that stuff. And I, you know, it was like, here's an opportunity to create something where you can have people tell their story.
Yeah.
What's it like living here? Why did you come out here? And so I don't know. It's just been a fun expression of that part of kind of our curiosity, and I just really enjoy it. So
I'm glad you're doing it. It's really great talking with you too.
Yeah, you too. So hopefully when you guys are back in the area after all and the pandemic is over,
yeah,
we'll get together and we'll have dinner and
it'd be fun we'll to do connect. A project together
soon. Absolutely. No, I look forward to it.
That'd be great.
So, Paul, thank you. It's been so good talking to you. And
all right. Say hey to Jen.
I will. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Okay.
Wow. Thank you so much for taking the time to interview Paul. And I'm so thankful Paul was on the podcast. I had a great time I got to spend a lot of time with Paul as we were looking for a house for him over a couple year period, I think. And I had a lot of great conversations, and he's just so insightful. I always left feeling, we had some deep conversations, feeling very moved and inspired. Did you have any takeaways, Ryan, from that interview with Paul?
Well, you know, I mean, as I mentioned to him in the interview, one of the things that I just have a real affinity for creative people. I mean, it's in the work that he and I both do with the film world, and then he's a writer, and which I'm a writer, and then Beth's a painter, and I'm a kind of a painter. And, you know, there's just this connection that I have with artists and filmmakers and storytellers and all that. So it's always fun for me to talk to people like that. I mean, I love business and I love entrepreneurship and all that as well, but there's something in my DNA that when I get around musicians and artists and writers and all that, it's just kind of like a magnet. I'm just drawn to people. So you've been talking about him for a while, and so it was really fun to actually get time to just sit and talk with him and kind of get to see his personality. And I have a feeling that we're all going to be very good friends for a long time. So
yes, he's a beautiful soul, and love Beth as well. I'm so glad that we got to hear more of his story. Again, so inspiring, and just the greatest guy, the greatest couple. And again, thank you for doing that. And thanks to them to Paul for being on and sharing his story and just being raw and open and honest with us today. Before we wrap it up, I wanted to remind you guys that, again, like I said at the beginning of the podcast episode, if you have any questions about the value of your home or whether you're looking to buy or sell or not, I'd be more than happy to email you a comparative market analysis. So go to jennifermckee.com. Also, I would love to connect with you guys on all the social media platforms. So Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn. My kids even talked me into getting a TikTok. Now, I haven't posted any videos yet, but find me in all those places.
I'm working on being TikTok famous.
Yes, you really are. This is one of your quarantine goals, right?
Yeah. We're actually going to have an interview here soon with a TikTok superstar. So
yeah, that's going to be fun. I'm really looking forward to that, actually. And connect with me. Find me on those places. And if you would please like and subscribe to this podcast and leave a review and all of those good things, it would really help. Thanks for hanging in here with us. Can't believe episode 10. I mean, it's crazy. It's a milestone for us, and we're looking forward to the next several hundred.
10.
The next 10. We'll take
20,
it 10 at a time.
50. See ya.
Bye.